All right, welcome to a slightly chaotic Ask Me Anything episode of Making Sense. Of course, we are supported by KiwiBank, and I am Frances Cook, your favorite independent financial journalist. And we are going to run through all of your questions today. Like I said, it's going to be slightly chaotic. I am just squeezing this in between a few other recordings, but I have been promising an Ask Me Anything episode. I've been collecting your questions for over a month and then just not getting around to it. So we're doing it. We're doing it today. I'm getting through as many as we can. We're on to it. So we're going to start with a fun one. I want to know more about your accent. There is more than one in there, right? I love it. I'm just curious. I love how we always have to, when it's a personal question, we always have to say, hey, nothing personal. I'm just curious about you, because we all freak out so easily these days. Yeah, no, I do. I have a couple of different accents. I was born in England. My mum is English. My dad is a New Zealander. And I come from a part of England. It's near Newcastle, a little place called Hexham. I'm actually from Hexhamshire. My husband likes to say I'm a hobbit because I'm from the Shire. But it is a Northern England accent, for anyone who knows that. If you've ever watched Geordie Shore, those are my people. That is what I originally sounded like. Now, we moved to New Zealand when I was 8. And so then my accent mutated quite a lot. It sounds more Southern England now, which my mum is mortified by, that I'm no longer a proper Northerner. Moved to New Zealand so that my dad could be back in his home country. To be honest, a terrible attempt to save the marriage. Didn't work, but I ended up in New Zealand. So that's really fun. I enjoyed that part of it. And yeah, now my accent is a weird blend of Northern England, Southern England, still don't know how that snuck in there, New Zealand, and then a little bit of American from watching too much TV. So there you go. There's a few. Financial questions, though. Is Shazzy's okay for a short-term savings account or too risky? E.g., $10,000 for a holiday in 6 months. Now, I don't want to comment specifically on particular Shazzy's products, right? Because things can change. Also, I don't want to give you specific financial advice. Everything that we're talking about in this episode, when it comes to the money side of things, I'm going to be talking generally because I don't know your situation. I don't know your money personality. There might be other things in your financials that would change what I would say. So everything here is sort of on face value, general rules of the game. It's just how it has to be when it's me just talking to a bunch of people at the same time, right? And so then when you're saying, is Shazzy's okay for the short-term savings account? Well, Shazzy's does also have savings products as well as shares products. So it depends what you're talking about there. If you're talking about their savings products, then that's fine. But if you're talking about putting money into shares and you're planning to use it for 6 months, here's one of the things. And I've got a couple of money education courses, and a key part of it, the thing that we usually talk about in the first week in both of the courses, is the money timeline. How long you have before you want to use that money, so important for what you decide you're going to use it for. And putting money into shares, you usually want at least 5 years, more like 10, to be honest, before you think you're going to touch that money again. It's really long-term money. And here's why, is because things can happen where the share market goes down in value really unexpectedly. And it's just part of how the share market works. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually part of how you make money in the long run. But if it happens unexpectedly and you need that money soon, that is how you lose money in the share market. So if you're talking about, should I put money into shares and I'm planning to use it in 6 months' time? Risky. Look, I can't stop you, but I would only do that if it's money that you're like, oh, I would like to use it in 6 months. But if something happens and the market goes down, I can leave it alone and go without it. That's probably the only situation where I'd say do that. So, FYI. What to do with a big windfall, around 1 million? That's a substantial windfall. Nice. Save, invest, or property? Okay. In terms of $1 million would be a lot to have in savings, right? So again, if we come back to this money timeline idea, how long before you think you'll need the money? So savings is usually money that you plan to use in within the next year or so, or you want to have it available for if something happens in the next year or so. So it might be your emergency savings for something like a car repair if your car goes ping and you need to sort that out, or just money that you need on hand for anything that could happen in the short term. And then investing or property, I'm assuming you mean, you know, investing into shares or property. That's more long-term money. That's 5 years plus. There's some in-between options there that are, if you're thinking more like 2 to 3 years before you use it, then maybe a term deposit or something like bonds can work a little better. But $1 million, I highly doubt you're going to use $1 million in the next year or so, unless you're really planning on living it up. Maybe you're like, woo, windfall, and it's all going to be spent. Again, your life, maybe that's what you want to do. But for most people, I think if you get a big windfall like that, you're probably thinking, how can I make the most of this? And you're probably looking for ways to build something long-term with that. Highly doubt you're going to spend that all in a year or planning to. So in terms of if you're balancing up, should I put it into something like shares or property? You probably need to think about lifestyle factors, because I know a lot of people talk about how you can turn property into a passive investment. Property is actually pretty high touch. You have to maintain it. You have to work well with your tenants, be available to them. You need to be ready for that to be, at the very least, sort of like a part-time job, which is totally fine if that's what you're ready for, but just be prepared for that. Something like shares, you might need to do a little bit of education to figure out what sort of investments you want on that front, but it's a lot lower touch. You can just stick your money in there and leave it alone once you've made your choice of how you want to invest. Shares just requires a little bit more of a good stomach for the market's going to go up and down. That's all part of it. You're not going to avoid it. So you just need to have the stomach for that. And part of what helps you build the stomach for that is understanding it. So read a couple of books, maybe talk to a financial advisor, but understand what you're getting into and that it's all okay if it goes up and down a little bit. So it's thinking about, what do you want to achieve with that money? And how much effort do you want to put into those achievements with that money? So it's not really a direct answer, but then again, it never is. So much of this stuff is so personal. What's your view on revolving credit? Love revolving credit, but be careful with it. So I'm just going to check something here. I'll get the editor to fast forward this bit while I find it. Right, here we go. So episode from 10th of October, the underrated way to pay off the mortgage early. That is all about revolving credit and understanding it. If you're watching this on YouTube, sorry, that episode isn't on YouTube, but it's on all the podcast apps. So Spotify, Apple Podcasts, yada, yada. It was before we were doing YouTube. That episode is great for understanding revolving credit. If you haven't come across that before, it's a type of mortgage where you can put more into it. And a lot of people use that to supercharge their mortgage repayments. So think of it like a big overdraft where you might carve off a bit of the mortgage. You can have more than one mortgage at once, right? So say you've paid $1 million for a house, pretty standard for a lot of people these days. And you think, I would like to pay off extra this year. And I think if I work really hard, I could pay off $30,000 extra on the mortgage this year. It's a stretch goal though, right? Like that's a lot of money in 1 year. And so you're going to work really hard and you hope to pay off that extra, but it's not guaranteed. So you might carve off $30,000 and say, that's a revolving credit mortgage. The reason why it's revolving, you can put money in, you can take it back out. So it's revolving. You can take your money in and out. just like a revolving door. So you can put everything extra that you can on that and end up paying a lot extra off your mortgage, which saves you thousands. Every dollar extra you can put on a mortgage is often worth at least two, because it saves you the future interest and fees. Really powerful, even if you only have $5 extra to put on the mortgage. So worth doing. The other good thing about revolving is that you have that safety net of, if something changes and you need that money back, then you can take it back out. So that's better than just increasing your repayments or having a floating rate where once that money's put in, that's locked in, it's gone. That amount of mortgage is paid off. The revolving means you have that safety net if you can take it back out if you need to. So it lets you go really hard while still having a safety net. But now here's the problem, that you have that safety net, that you can take it back out, because the revolving credit will have a slightly higher interest rate in most cases. Now, if you stick with it and put the extra money into it, paying off that extra will outweigh the extra interest. But if you're someone who isn't very good at self-control and you see that money, you're like, oh, I could just go to brunch and it's only $30, so it doesn't matter. But you do that like every weekend and you end up putting money in and taking it out and putting money in and taking it out, then you'll just be paying higher interest rates for nothing and you can go backwards instead. So here's a little rule of thumb for whether or not revolving credit might be good for you. Have you ever had problems with paying your credit card on time or building up more debt than you wanted to? If you've had issues with debt and you've found it hard to stay on top of before, revolving credit will probably hurt you. But if you're someone who pays off the credit card every single month, you maybe use it for points, you're like, you know, perfect little debt angel, then revolving credit can be really good for you. But you need to be that sort of person who's got really good self-control. Now, you can change your attitude to debt, but I would build up that muscle first. I would make sure you're practiced at paying off the credit card every month, not having things like Afterpay, and really build the strength of that muscle of being good with debt. You can totally build that muscle, but build that muscle elsewhere first before trying the revolving credit. So yeah, really powerful for getting ahead on your mortgage, but money mindset comes into it, like all things. This question is interesting. Why can't I include my house equity in my retirement savings maths? I don't know. Why can't you? Has someone told you you can't? I think you can. So I don't know who told you you can't, but I think you can. Now, be aware that different financial advisors, different financial experts will have different approaches to things. And that's not necessarily because anyone's wrong. It's just that there is more than one way to get ahead with your money. Truly there is. And that's why I love that there are different financial educators in the space, because something I say to you might not make sense to you. And you think, I usually like what she says, but that doesn't feel right to me. That's cool. Trust your gut. Trust your instinct on what works for your life, because you know your life better than I do. But there's also, you know, there's different financial experts that will have different tactics. But to me, so house equity, for anyone who hasn't paid attention on that, that's how much of your house you've paid off. So say you buy a house, let's say $1 million again, nice round numbers, and you put $200,000 down as a deposit. That's your equity. You have equity of $200,000 in your home. You actually own that amount. And people often talk about it as a percentage. So that would be 20% equity. And then all the mortgage repayments you're making as you slowly pay off that mortgage, that's building your equity. So in terms of including your equity in your retirement calculations, maybe someone has told you that you shouldn't because they're not sure what you plan to do with it, because there can be different things that you do with that stake you have in your home. You can use it as security on other loans. Maybe you want to start a business. It can be easier to get a business loan if you use your home equity. Little risky. Make sure the business doesn't go under. But so that's one thing. Or you can use your home to help you get into investment property. Or you might just pay off that home really well. And then by the time you hit retirement, your house is fully paid off. Now you're still going to have things like rates and insurance and a little bit of maintenance on that home, but you've just got rid of a huge cost. People's home ownership costs can be 50% of their spending. It can be enormous. So you've just saved a massive chunk of money. So whatever you're planning to do, whether it's just you're going to have a paid off home or you're planning to use it to build up other investments or a business or whatever, of course, I mean, I think your home equity absolutely factors into that. It's just it might factor in different ways. You can see already there's different options there. So yes, factor it in, but make sure you're factoring it in terms of how that works for you. And even if it's just, well, my costs are going to be this much lower. Brilliant. Now you need less money in retirement, don't you? Great. What else do we have here? Oh gosh, we are speeding through time. Okay, I'm not going to get through all of these questions. What should you use your emergency fund for? I find it hard to let go of. That is totally fair, and that is a really common problem. Not a problem I struggle with. See, I'm more of your spender, which means my superpower is investing. I always say, whether you're a spender or a saver naturally, you do have superpowers, and spenders get so much grief, but spenders find it easier to invest because it feels like spending. You're putting money in buying all these lovely companies. It's great. Savers, your superpower is very obvious. You're doing great. It's stacking your cash away and you're doing really well. But the drawback is less obvious, where sometimes you're going to find it hard to spend money even when you should. So that is hard. It's so funny to frame that as a problem, but it is. It's a real genuine problem. If you have an emergency come up, that's what your emergency savings are for. That's what you put them there for. Say thank you to your past self and use it and then build it up again. So I don't know how much your emergency fund is. I mean, people have different emergency fund amounts, but say you've got $1,000 for an emergency fund and then you get a flat tire on the way to work. And so I don't know how much your tires are, but say that's $200 and that sucks. Really, do you know what sucks? I think this is one of the things about emergency funds that makes it hard to spend the money is it's never on something you want. Like, who wants to spend money on a tire? Whoop-de-doo. But that's what it's there for. And it's saving you from credit card debt. So thank you, past me. Let's spend this and then build it back up again. $50 a week, you're settled again by the end of the month. But the other thing is, if you're someone who's struggling to even spend your emergency savings, I just want to put out there, have you allocated some of your money to fund money? And I know that some people are on really tight budgets. I get that. But whatever your budget is, can you please allocate something to fund money or you're going to lose your mind, even if it's $10 a week? That can get you like a chocolate bar and a nice drink, and you go and sit somewhere with a good view and contemplate life, the universe, and everything, and you just have a little bit of you time. You know, whatever it is, even if it's little, please have something allocated for fun money. And the thing is, when you've allocated it and you've put it in your budget and you've said, this is my fun money and I get to do this with it, then that is what it's for. And it takes away the guilt because it's been labeled as your fun money. And if you need permission, I'm giving you permission right now, because otherwise you will lose your mind, you'll snap, and you'll end up spending way too much on something else. It'll be far beyond the $10 that you would have allocated, because you're going to feel like a starving person. And when you break that dam, you're going to go crazy. And then you're going to have ground to catch up. So have some sort of fun money. Also, life is for living. So make sure there's something there for living. Ooh, speaking of, I have a job that pays terribly. It's about $30,000 per year, but I love it. Should I change to a higher paying job? I love how much faith you guys have in me to answer these questions. that is so deeply personal. It depends what you want to achieve. Do you feel like you're falling behind financially? Do you have other things that you want to achieve financially? Could you get some of the things that you love about that job in a different job that pays more? Could you achieve some of the things you want to achieve financially if you changed to a different job for a short period of time and then came back? I mean, look, $30,000 a year isn't much. I'm going to assume, probably based on that, that it's not full-time, because I think full-time on minimum wage, in New Zealand at least, puts you roughly in the 40K range. I can't remember fully what it is. But I'm going to assume that you're not full-time there. So I don't know what sort of, if you have kids or whatever as well, so maybe you can't work full-time, but could you do some sort of side hustle that boosts up your earning? What you need to do is, it's not just, should I be earning more? Because money for the sake of money doesn't make any sense. If you are happy and getting along fine and you really love this job, stick with it. If you feel like there are certain things I'm not going to be achieving if I stay here, maybe you're the sole earner of your household and you want to buy a house. That's going to be really, really hard on 30K a year. Or you're thinking that sometime in the future you'd like to go on a big trip. That's going to be hard to save for. So you need to think about, what are your goals? Why would you even want to change? And then working backwards from there, okay, if there are things that you want to be achieving, can you do it with a side hustle? Can you find another job that has aspects of what you love here that pays more? What else can you do? But it's all going to come down to the why. So you actually need to think about, what is the question behind this? What are you trying to achieve? It's not money for the sake of money. Love this one. What are your qualifications? This one's just to me. So can I just say thank you for asking this question? Because I think you should ask this of anyone who is talking about money online, because I see a lot of gurus, shall we call them, who are not qualified and who give very worrying advice, and they clearly don't even know enough to know that they're breaking the law with some of the things that they are saying. There are also so many fantastic people who are entirely qualified and are giving amazing information for free on Instagram, on YouTube, on TikTok, but it can be really hard to see the difference. So I think you should always look into someone's qualifications and check their background. So me, personally, I mean, I have too many degrees, but I'm assuming that you're asking about my financial ones. So I am qualified. I have the level 5 financial certification that in New Zealand is the qualification for being a financial advisor. And I specialize in investments, so shares, property. You can also specialize in mortgages. You can also specialize in insurance. I have debated adding those specialties just to learn a bit more. But frankly, I just haven't had the time. So if I'm really honest, I just haven't had the time. But yeah, so I specialized in investments there. I've also worked as a financial journalist for 10 years-ish, where I was very lucky to be interviewing some of the biggest, best business minds, financial advisors, people who run huge investing companies. So not only getting that background of, you know, the book learning, which is great, recommend, but also picking the brains of some of the incredible leaders in this industry. And I learn so much from that all the time. And I think that's why, even as I'm not fully financially independent, but I'm close these days, even as I am less reliant on a job to pay my wages, I just am so hooked on this, because the fascinating people you get to talk to, the amount I get to learn every day is so great. And so I love that. So there's both the qualification learning and the 10 years in the industry learning that I've got behind me. What I do want to say, though, thank you so much to everyone who direct messages me, who says they would like coaching or financial advising from me. I so appreciate that. I am not registered as a financial advisor. So there's the in New Zealand. This is the system in New Zealand. It's going to be different in every country. There's the qualification as a financial advisor that then allows you to register to then operate as a financial advisor. And that's what would let me meet with you one-on-one, look at all your financials and say, here's what you should do. You should have this investing product. You should put your money into these shares. This KiwiSaver is going to be great for you. Get you all sorted. I am not registered for that because the system in New Zealand is kind of interesting, where to be able to do exactly what I'm doing right now, it is easier for me to do that as a journalist. There is special protections in our laws for journalists to be able to operate and talk about money. Because if a financial advisor is doing all of what I do and educating people, brilliant, but they might be influenced by the products they sell. Maybe say there's a certain KiwiSaver that if they recommend people to that and people sign up, they might get a little commission on that. So it's actually for very good reason that they say financial advisors are quite strictly limited on what they can say and the sort of financial education they can give publicly, speaking sort of one to many, because there might be those influences in there because they get a kickback. So, like I say, for very good reason, there are restrictions on what a financial advisor can say and do in terms of the education space. And so I basically made a choice and said, I think I can help more people and get more information to more people, which is what I see value in from me. That's what I think is my strength. I can do that as a financial journalist. I can do that by going harder on what I have been doing as a journalist, making sure I'm fully qualified, fully across things, make sure I'm saying stuff that is based in fact. But by operating as a journalist and giving up the possibility of financial advising, I can help more people. So that's the choice that I made. You can have anything but not everything at once. And so I chose that. I do have my courses, which are general information about how the money world works, which will teach you about the share market and different strategies for investing. But then you will take that learning on yourself and say, okay, how does this apply to my life? And then you make decisions from there. I'm not going to tell you specifically what to do. I can't legally. And be so careful of anyone who gets behind a camera and says, you should invest in this because it's great and everyone should invest in it. That is the world's biggest red flag of someone who is either a scammer or an idiot, because they're breaking the law by doing that. And either they know and they don't care, or they don't even know enough to know that's breaking the law, which is a huge red flag. So, FYI. Ooh, okay. This one's a curly one. I have $18,000 in credit card debt and $15,000 in shares. Do I cash it in and pay off the credit card debt? Right after that little spiel on being careful about people who are giving individual advice, I've got to say, obviously, this is an individual situation that we're talking about here, but this is going to be talking generally speaking, because it's a great question and you've given me some good info, but I don't know everything that's happening in your personal life, okay? So this is general terms, what should many people do in this situation? Here's the problem with credit card debt. Credit card debt will, in most situations, cost you more than shares will make you. Now, I love shares. I think they're brilliant. And they make you good money over a good period of years, ideally, in most situations. But credit card debt is still going to cost you more than that. So even if your shares are going well and they're making money, that credit card debt is pulling you back by more than you're making in most situations. So maybe Look, if it was my situation, yes, I would sell the shares and pay off the credit card debt. And that last 3K that's left over from the credit card debt, I would get that smashed down as fast as you can. The trick is, if you've built up credit card debt before, you want to make sure that if you're sacrificing those investments, that you don't build up the credit card debt again, that you don't see that clear credit card and go, woohoo, let's go out in the town to celebrate and build up another $1,000 of debt. And then before you know it, you're back to $5,000 and it all builds up again. Once that credit card debt is gone, make sure it stays gone and get back to the investing and build that up again. But if you're concerned about that, you could think about getting in touch with a financial advisor and talk to them about it to get that proper one-on-one information. Now, many financial advisors will have a meeting with you, the first meeting with you for free. So you can ask them and say, you know, what would you do for someone in my position? Should I do this? And then, of course, they're hoping to sign you up and get you investing through them when you're eventually investing. But part of their job should be to help get you on that financial footing, that solid financial footing. A big credit card debt like that is not solid financial footing. I suspect most financial advisors would tell you to get that paid off. I know it's going to feel like going backwards, but just make sure, like I say, once that credit card is gone, cut it up. I'm actually thinking of doing a newsletter on how to find a good financial advisor. So please let me know in the comments or message me on social media if that's something you would be interested in, because I get a lot of questions about it. And I'm thinking maybe if I do a newsletter on it and then put sort of an archived version of that somewhere so that you can find it and come back to it whenever you like. Would that be useful? Let me know, because I know a lot of people panic about finding a good financial advisor. Copy trading. Is it too high risk? So copy trading, for anyone who hasn't come across that, is there are certain apps that let you do it, that you might identify a certain trader or someone. And whenever that person that you're copying makes a trade, they buy, they sell an investment, whatever, you automatically make the same trade or investment. Now, in terms of if it's too risky, well, that kind of depends who you're copying. But here's my actual problem with copy trading. You're assuming that these people are really good at what they do. There are a lot of people out there who say they're the best, and there are a lot of people who can have one or two great years in the market, and it's often luck. And then it all balances out and they have a couple of terrible years in the market. There's lots of famous studies on, you know, there was a chimpanzee, I think, that they got to pick stocks and ended up being one of the top traders that year just by pure luck. I just don't see anyone as this great shining light of, oh, they definitely know what's going on. Actually, there was one, Brian Gaynor, who used to run Milford Asset Management, who is unfortunately dead now. He was amazing. And I felt like he did know the investment world better than anyone else. But I even still wouldn't have copied someone like him, because everyone is human and everyone is fallible. I just stick my money into, this is my strategy, right? And I always hesitate to say my personal strategy, because this is what works for my money personality, my goals. That doesn't mean it's necessarily right for you. But for me, I just stick my money right now into a global index fund, which means it's a really big automatic investment into hundreds of companies all around the world. So you've got different economies, France, Australia, the US, they're all included. I think there's even some from New Zealand, little old New Zealand sneaks in there. You've got different industries. There's, you know, technology in there. There'll be healthcare in there, all of that stuff. It is so widely spread around. And it's really funny. For those who've been following for a while, you'll know my husband loves to pick individual companies. And I'm just like, I'm busy. I don't have time. I just need to make sure I'm invested. huck it in this frickin' global index fund. Leave it. It's fine. Moving on. I've got other stuff to do. And he keeps checking our different investment returns. And I'm always ahead of him. He's done so much research. He's picked his companies. He's got some that are doing so great, but there's also some that aren't. And my boring old index fund is always at least 2 percentage points ahead of him. And I just like saying that publicly, that I'm winning. It's quite nice. But, you know, that is the thing, you know. The problem with copy trading is not necessarily to me the risk of it. Like, depending on who you're copying, yeah, it can be pretty risky. The problem is just that I just don't think these people are that great. Why would I copy them? I don't think they're going to make me more money. Even if they made a lot last year, who's to say they're going to do it again this year? I think they got lucky. So I'm going to choose my global index fund. Probably make more than the rest of them combined. And there's so much data that backs that up. So there you go. Oh, this is a great one. A few people asked me about this. Can you do a solar power podcast? Tell us how it works in your home to save money. So for anyone who doesn't follow me on social media, we got solar power, which I'm so excited about. We did a lot of research beforehand. We didn't do one of those rent schemes where they just put the solar panels on your roof and you technically don't pay for it. We did it where you can get these green loans, at least here in New Zealand, where it's a 1% interest rate. It's a special thing to encourage anything that's considered environmentally friendly. You can get an electric car on that too, FYI. So you can do that. It's very cheap lending and you can get things like solar power for your house. And so we did that and spoiler alert, it's going great. We've done some projections on how long it will take, how much money we need to save over what sort of length of time for it to fully pay itself off. But we're still working on all that. So what I want to do is... Again, with my husband being an absolute nerd, this time all of his extra work is paying off. So he is tracking all of this obsessively and he's got bar charts and all sorts. And what I'm hoping to do is convince him to come on the podcast. We'll see. Wish me luck. Convince him to come on the podcast and share those bar charts with us once we've got a few months of data. So once I know truly how it's working out, then share all the full numbers with you, exactly how much we're saving on power, exactly how long we're thinking it will take for it to pay itself off, and how it all worked for us and what was behind it. So let me know if you're keen on that. I've certainly had a few people in the DMs asking about it. If only a few people are interested, maybe I'll just do a newsletter on it or something. But if a lot of people are keen, then we can do a full podcast episode. Let me know. I'm going to go by how many of you get in touch. So if you want it, tell me. But yeah, the spoiler alert is it went really well. Used a green home loan to help make it affordable, saving hundreds already per month. So loving it. What's the best looking banknote? The one that's in my hand. I don't know. What's the $100 note? Is that purple? Orange? Whatever. The biggest one I can get and the one that's in my hand. Ooh, how do you feel about buying into shares for a company you work for? So, again, it depends on the company you're working for, right? Here's the potential problem with it. This is your job, so it's your main income already. And then if it's the only investment you have, then that is all your eggs in one basket. Take it from someone who used to work in the media industry. I don't really think you should put all your eggs in one basket. A company can go under very unexpectedly. It can happen too fast for you to protect yourself. And then you've lost both your job and your investments. Now, if it's a nice to have, if you have things like your KiwiSaver or other retirement fund, or if you have side business elsewhere, then you're just putting a little bit of money into the company you work for as well, then that can work great. Because a lot of these employee investment plans, they'll give you great perks, most of them. They'll maybe match you, or they'll give you a cheaper price on the shares. It's a nice little perk for working there and getting you feeling invested in the success of the company. They want you to feel like if you work harder, then you're getting something back for it. Because the company does well, you get that back from dividends or your shares increasing, which is great. I mean, I think that's a beautiful way of sharing the love. It's really great. But I wouldn't have it be my only investment. That's my note of caution. So yes, if it's there and there's perks, cool, go for it. Just don't make it your only thing. Eggs in one basket. All right, I'm going to have to wrap this up soon. But, ooh, this is a slightly long one. Firstly, I want to thank you for your podcast and social media content. Currently listening to Your Money, Your Future on Audible and finding it invaluable. Yay, glad you're enjoying. I have a question. You may cover it later in the book, but patience is not my strong suit. Identify. I would love to know your opinion on paying down your mortgage versus investing. I'm so unsure of the best plan of action and would love to hear your thoughts. Okay, that is covered in both of my books, so you may be there already by the time you hear this. But here's the thing. I want to say this ahead of time. Mortgage versus investing is something that even financial advisors disagree on. Things can get fairly heated in the comment section about this. So again, horses for courses. Here's where I come from on it. On the pure numbers of whether you should pay off the mortgage versus invest, it's a bit like the credit card question earlier, right? Debt costs you more than you will make from investments. So on the pure numbers, paying off your mortgage fast makes more sense. You will financially get ahead faster. Here's the problem with that. Money is never pure numbers. There is so much from your mindset and from your life, just life factors that will massively impact what you do with your money. So a lot of people get like 95% of the way to paying off their mortgage. And then they're like, I'm 20 years ahead of schedule. And I'm about to have my mortgage paid off. And that's brilliant. And I'm going to celebrate by putting in a swimming pool. Or I'm just going to extend the house. Or actually, maybe we could sell this house and buy a slightly bigger one. You know, we're so close to done. We've paid this off really fast. We can do it again. And it just gets pushed further and further out. And what you end up with is this lovely house that will eventually be paid off and absolutely no investments. You cannot eat your spare room. You need something in retirement that's also making you money so you can keep the lights on, so that you can eat, so you can take the grandkids out. You need something that makes you money. And the thing about investments is they need time to work their magic. You know, it's like I was talking about with the money timeline earlier. The longer you have to leave your money alone, the more money you make, ideally, in most situations. Caveat, caveat. For most situations, I think it makes more sense to, if you've got some extra money that's your future building money and you're thinking, where do I put it? Why do you have to pick? 50-50. That's what I'm personally doing. I'm really putting my money where my mouth is on this one, where it's, I do 50% of my extra money onto the mortgage and 50% of the extra money into investments. And that way I'm hedging my bets on my money strategy and myself, because I'm paying off some debt. I'm saving a big cost for the future. And I'm also building something that makes money. And so if something happens with either one, whether it's the share market or the housing market or whatever, I've got more than one thing keeping me afloat. And that's so often the best strategy with everything money. Is that more than one thing, more than one strategy is what makes you safer. It's like the old thing of, you know, a rope is strong because it's lots of little fibers twisted together, more than one thing, all supporting each other. That's what makes something strong. So that's what I think. I think a 50-50 split of any of that future money across the two. All right, we're finishing on a fun one. What's the best thing you've ever spent money on, aka not investing or a house? And this, I love this because I struggled for such a long time to justify just spending money on something just for me. I could be really generous with those I care about and love. I could end up spending a lot on things that I felt were an investment into my education, into my future, into my career. I have struggled on, despite being a spender, I've struggled on allowing myself mentally to just want something nice, that it is okay if it fits in your budget to just have something nice. And so actually, this one is just this week. I bought some art and it was only $150, quite cheap as art goes, but I never buy art. And that is the ultimate, there's no point to it. It's just nice. It doesn't do anything. This is not art that's going to go up in value in the future. It's just something I wanted on my wall. And I bought it. And it was nice. And I like it. And I'm really trying to do a bit more of that because I am fortunate enough that I have that money in my budget these days, that I can have a certain amount of, this is just nice and I just want it. I'm not going to go crazy with it. I'm not buying $1,000 piece of art. There's kids in this house. They'll ruin it. But I bought it and I like it and I'm really pleased with it. So there you go. If it fits your budget and it makes you happy, do it. All right. That's everything we have time for. A mildly chaotic Ask Me Anything. That's it for this one. Don't forget to hit subscribe on Making Sense. And also, if you want your questions to be included in future episodes, come and find me on social media. I'm pretty much everywhere. So it's Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube, mostly as Frances Cook NZ. On YouTube, of course, we are under Making Sense Pod. So hit subscribe, send me any of those questions for the future, and we'll stay in touch. Until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.